Hello, Get More Auditors. Today we are super lucky to have with us Dan Hill. And of course, we'll start with the very first question. Dan, who are you?
Well, I'm a guy with a PhD in English who found himself in the business world. And I think the reason it happened was because of an article I read in a Cornell University publication talking about the breakthroughs in brain science and how much we are intuitive, emotional decision makers. And if you ask me who I am, I would say the bottom line is I'm a curious guy. And when you pose me the question, who in the world are people? How do they make decisions? How do they act? How do they behave? And you tell me there's an answer that's coming in out of left field. I get even more intrigued because my life is a series of coming from left field. When I was 6 years old, my family moved to Italy. I
All
did
right.
not know the language. I had to go to Italian first grade in a fishing village, and I waited all day for the math unit. But in the meantime, I tried to figure out who my classmates were. What are the dynamics? Who's reacting to whom? What's the teacher like? What's the underlying hidden agenda? So, really, I'm a curious guy who's interested in human nature and has come to believe that yes, emotions drive who we are. So, I could go on for an hour with that question because it's a lovely one, but that's a basic answer for you.
Well, we still have time, you know. So here's the question. Why a PhD in English? I mean, about the language, right? When you say in English,
Yes.
it's about the language. I've
Well,
always been intrigued by that because being a basic guy, I'm a scientist, so it's even worse than you. So I was originally a scientist, so it's even worse. For me, the language is something that's it's there. Right? We know how it works and so on. So what can you study to write a PhD about the language, about English?
when I say English, I really ultimately meaning the literature that is written in the English language. But again, I would say that the first language that I had to deal with was Italian. The whole idea that you could actually communicate in words was a stretch for me initially. I mean, I'm one of the few Norwegian Americans by ancestry who gets in the car by saying andiamo and says mi dispiace and abbastanza bene and so forth. So English would not be the obvious place to go. If anything, maybe I should have been a social scientist or a historian or something else. But I think English intrigued me because it's about trying to find your voice and trying to understand other people. So the literature that I was drawn to really had a moral compass and had high stakes in terms of what was happening in society. And it had to do with empathy and understanding others. And even though it seems far afield, I think ultimately, since I found myself in the business world, those attributes are useful because I would argue that way too often business people are emotionally illiterate, that they do not think as much about their customers as they think about the revenue stream, and that it gave me a unique out-of-the-box perspective that I tried to use on behalf of my clients. So that's how I got myself into literature, looking for the voice of the experience, the inner life of the characters, the poet, the essayist. If it's a play, what's happening on stage, and what are the emotional dynamics of what's happening?
So would you agree that in fact, because that's something I teach, I use that from research where I say, in fact, it said that in fact, 93% of the message you are sending to other people is not the words you are using. It's about your body, it's about your voice. So would you,
And I
based on
don't,
what
yeah.
you said, I think you would agree with that, right?
Oh, I utterly agree with that. And that's the great irony of having a PhD in English, is that I found myself actually making my living by looking at the nonverbals instead. But I'm okay with that because I can always say to my clients, I appreciate what words can do, but I'm also here to tell you that words are not nearly enough. And especially if you're doing market research where you think the paid participants are going to tell you the truth when a moderator is taking them through the agenda of questions, and you have peer pressure and people who are inarticulate, where it may not be their natural language, they may not feel they have the same educational level as the moderator. My God, there's one impediment after another, beyond the fact we just don't consciously always know how we really feel. Human beings are not truth tellers. I mean, what we really want to do is feel good about ourselves and attract allies. And the truth is a casualty more times than not of those two realities. And so I always found it immensely amusing that companies were spending so much money on product design, on advertising, and they were depending on words that were a very thin vessel for getting there. And that's before we get into the politics that an advertising agency can take a creative brief and turn it inside out to defend their work because their bottom goal is to stay alive. So there is so much going on in the words. Yeah, they're up against a very tough reality.
Yeah, it's very funny that I mean, I'm going from the neuromarketing world and now to neuropersuasion, but that you see that there are some companies, marketing agencies that try to push it too far from my perspective. I don't know if you agree, but for example, everything which has to do with a perfume, you know, they always go, I think, too far because they don't even tell a story anymore. It's just something crazy about, I don't know, their name or the name of the perfume. And then you have the other ones who everything which has to do with medication has to have complex words and formulas if you look at their marketing. So I mean, do you agree with that, or you think it's they do a good job?
We do not have our brain is not, Microsoft 8.0. I mean, we are very basic creatures. And you start to talk about a perfume, for instance, which is a fascinating thing because, as you would well know, the origin of the brain is actually our sense of smell, sitting atop the spinal column. So that is the most ancient of all the senses, and our ability to summon words to capture our olfactory experience is a real challenge for people. My God. So you start throwing complex formulas at it, or what my father called 25-cent words when everyone's talking in penny words in reality, or that's how their brain is functioning. It's pretty funny. And we are not on message creatures. I mean, this goes back to my comment earlier about we're not truth tellers either. But there sits the marketer and the company thinking it's all wrapped up in words and messaging. And I would argue it's wrapped up in our sensory emotive experiences. That's how the brain is based.
It's very funny to see also that, as you say, they use words. I mean, we are speaking for only 30,000 years, and we are communicating through words for around 10,000 years, and still people focus on, you know, they want the brochure, they want complex websites, stuff like that. It's very funny that in fact the rational brain is driving everything, knowing that the primary brain, the decision maker, is definitely not working that way. So
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely the case. The biggest lies in life are the ones we tell ourselves. And the biggest lies of all is probably, oh, yeah, I'm a rational decision maker.
yeah.
Everyone else is crazy, but I am not.
Yeah, what I always tell people is to think about the last thing you purchased, you know? Just think about the last thing you purchased. And try to remember, or the next time you buy something, try to see what's going on in your brain, you know? Oh, I bought this watch, but it makes a lot of sense because la la la. And you have that rational process where trying to make sure that you're in agreement with yourself that you made a very unrational decision, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, let's even go back to my career for a moment. So, you're a scientist. My father was an engineer. So, there's a great theory out there by a man named Bloom who said it's the anxiety of influence. Shakespeare was greater than Milton, who was greater than Wordsworth, and it goes on and on and on. Everybody's afraid of who came before them that they can't meet or exceed them. So, what did I do on some subconscious level? I believe I probably said, oh my God, my father's really good at equations and numbers and formulas. I ain't going there. I'm going to go someplace else. And he wasn't so good at English. He got C's in English. Everything else was A's. So maybe deep down, the truth of the matter is I fled to some distant, kingdom of the world where my dad couldn't rule.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I did somehow the same thing. You know, the day I could show him that I knew something more than he did. Wow. That was
Yeah, no,
cool.
it delights us, you know.
Yeah.
We want to get out of that grasp.
Yeah, they're pretty sure our kids do exactly the same. All
Yeah, I think so.
right. So tell us what you are doing and why you are doing it.
Well, I think the medium that I really fell into loved using my facial coding tool, because that's how I get at people's emotions. I mean, there are many ways to go at it. fMRI brain scans are fascinating. Emily Dickinson said that the brain is wider than the sky. It's an awfully complicated thing with all of its billions of neurons. The face is a bit easier. So in my case, I like the fact that it was visually oriented because, again, going back to Italy, guess what? Italians use a lot of body language, a lot of hand gestures. It's very visual. It gives you a way into what's happening for them. So I liked the face, and I also happen to have been an art history minor in college back in the day. So I'm a visually oriented guy, and so I liked facial coding. Probably the execution that I'm most famous for, excelled at, was actually looking at advertising. And the
Okay.
reason for that is you still got the words, but particularly in TV, what you really have is the visuals. And if you go to something like radio, for instance, you've also got how do you say the words? What's the pace, the intonation,
Right.
the energy level in the voice? So there are lots of things going on beyond the words themselves, but they at least nominally play a role. And I love the brevity because I'm not sure if I mentioned this yet, but when I studied literature, my specialty was really poetry, which is really concise. And so is the 30-second TV spot. You don't have a chance to say a whole lot in a 30-second spot.
Right.
And you want to tell a story, I would argue, to your point earlier, but you actually don't even have time to tell the story. All you can do is hint at the story or give a little facsimile of the story because the story would take minutes and you've got seconds. And so that's really where I think I specialized.
Okay, so and what are you doing nowadays?
I am using the tool to try to help clients understand how not to waste their bloody money. I think they go back to that famous British philosopher Mick Jagger said, "More and more of this useless information supposed to fire my imagination. I don't get no satisfaction." They need to create some satisfaction, and they're not going to do it rationally. So I am trying to tell them, for instance, when in the commercial do they manage to emotionally engage people? Because if
Okay.
you do not get emotional engagement, it means that you are not motivating people. You are not going to create something that is memorable for them. You are not going to get to your bottom line because you haven't gotten to their bottom line, which is why should I care? Do I care? How much do I care? When do I care? You have to find what I call the pivot points, the moments in the commercial that really break through. And I can tell you quite honestly, they rarely come during the messaging because that's boring. It's what's in it for the company,
Right.
that's what is in it for the customer. And the branded close, because almost all commercials come with about 3 to 5 seconds where the logo is static on the screen. You've thrown away the visual. You put the tagline or the company name on the screen. So now you're asking them to read, but it's actually a visual medium. And they're on the sofa thinking about going to get ice cream. And none of that is working. And it's the story, it's the imagery, it's the magic that you're creating outside of the messaging that's actually going to carry the whole bloody thing.
Right,
And
right.
I'm trying to alert them to that, and I'm trying to be honest without blowing up their day and telling them what's working, what's not working. And I have a particular phrase that I use with them. I say, look out for the bald spot. And I'm not trying to pick on guys, but what I mean by a bald spot is when do people emotionally drop out of the commercial? Does
Right.
it happen? It tends to happen a lot, particularly when the messaging gets introduced. People flee the room. Elvis has left the building when these moments happen. And I can really help them not waste their money by saying, here's your bald spot. Here's why I think it happened. here's your solutions, and I will try to look toward color scheme, visuals, intonation, wording, sure, but that's not only the only factor.
Okay, so that would be you making running this analysis.
It would, but I am trying to come from the voice or the heart of the customer. I'm not trying to play idiot savant and imagine that I have every answer because I'm overeducated. I got a PhD and two master's degrees, and I am not the average consumer. So I start with what I can capture from the facial coding. So that's the objectivity, that's the science. And then, yes, I tell them this is the numbers, these are the facts such as they are. But here's also my voice and vision and experience and gut sense of what that means, why it's happening, and what you can do about it. And you can just stick with the numbers and work out your own solution. Or if you'd like to, you can take my 20 plus years of experience and plug that in. And I'd like to think that's part of the value that I deliver. But that's the whole package. That's what I'm trying to do for them on their
Okay.
behalf.
So here's a question for you. I mean, I do coaching and with my colleagues, partners, we notice, and most people notice, that 1% only of the people who ask you to help them and to work for them will implement what you tell them. So do you have this, do you experience the same thing, or do they change what they have done, or on a higher scale?
Actually, I'm fairly successful because I try to say things in a memorable, lively way and make them understand that I actually care about their outcome, that it's not just booking an invoice with them. So, do I get everything that I'm trying to suggest? Not necessarily. Sometimes I don't get anything at all, to your point, because human nature is we don't like to change a whole lot.
Absolutely.
Egos get invested, money's been invested. TV spots, for instance, are expensive to create, and the agency doesn't want to admit they make a mistake. So I'm not trying to shame them or put them on the spot. I'm trying to save their spot. And so I'll put out several different ideas. I might say it in several different ways, to make my point. But I would say that, in baseball, you're a great hitter if you can hit 300. I think I'm in the Hall of Fame. I think I get past 300% in terms of how often they take my suggestion. Do I bat 1,000? Oh my God, no. That would be amazing. I would be a Nobel Peace Prize winner if I could get 1,000.
Yeah, you would have understood human nature at its deepest.
Oh yeah, no, I would
And
be phenomenal.
so I guess because you speak about emotions, and that's what you analyze, you know about Antonio Damasio and the
Oh, of
fact
course.
that he expresses that you need an emotional variation and not just
Yes.
one emotion.
Yes. And his point is, we're not thinking machines. We're feeling entities. No,
Absolutely,
no.
yeah.
Damasio was fundamental. When I got started, that Cornell University article that I mentioned earlier, practically the next thing that I happened is I read Damasio, and then I read the next person and the next person. But Damasio is right in there, central to the whole mix.
Yeah, he is fundamental. And would you agree that many people think, because I mean, yes, they have started to understand that you need emotions, but most of the time they think one emotion is doing the job. If I make them laugh, they will remember me. Or if I make them cry, they will be buying my products. And you see a lot of commercials that are still sticking to that, or do they start to move towards more emotional variations?
I'm going to tell you a funny story. So I'm meeting with a London advertising agency, a very prominent one on behalf of my client. And I said to them, so you agree that it's not just to be on message, you have to be on emotion. You have to create the right emotion at the right time on behalf of your product, your positioning, your brand, et cetera. And I say, so what emotion are you, do you think you're give me some of the emotions you're typically trying for that you think are central for this particular client that we're both doing work for? And I said, oh, the most important emotion we're trying for is consideration. And I tried to keep a straight face. And I said, I'm sorry, but consideration is not an emotion.
Nope.
It's a business objective. So let's keep the conversation going a bit longer. But yeah, so you face a lot of emotional illiteracy as opposed
Right.
to literacy. And yes, if you can really bring them along They will most likely want to go to, first and foremost, happiness. And in
Yeah.
some sense, I agree with them because happiness means fulfillment. Or if you're selling hope, a variation of that, that means the promise that in the future I will be happy. So I do think you want to get there, but that's not the only thing because, for instance, and I believe you'll agree with me, happiness can happen for a lot of reasons, and a company is not in the humor business.
Yeah.
They might really enjoy the joke that's in the commercial, but it can overshadow the product, the branded offer, and you may be nowhere as a result of that. It might be what's, the equivalent of that visually is a visual vampire that sucks up all the energy in the room. So humor is really delicate. Yes, it's a fabulous emotion because it's fulfillment. It opens people's windows of consideration. We don't close down. We have had an emotional response, but there's also fear because I would argue if you look at the core emotions, most of them are negative, which means we're trying to survive as a species. We're trying not to endanger ourselves. So fear means we're up against something that we feel like we can't compete with, we can't conquer. Our situation is out of control. It could be sadness that we are feeling forlorn and abandoned. It could be anger. We want a tech project product that we actually can understand that doesn't leave us confused. I mean, there are so many other emotion, or to your point, blends of emotions that we need to take into account. And so a lot of my work is, even though I have a PhD in English and thought I'd left academia, I'm still in academia. I am trying to teach people what
Yeah.
emotions are, what neurobiology is, and what its implications are. And every conversation is a education where I'm trying to spoon feed it, not in a condescending way, because we all have our limitations, but I am trying to raise the discourse and bring them along. And that does involve enriching the palette of emotions. I mean, as we're talking, I'm looking at your logo and I've got a multicolored brain. And my point is, it's not monochromatic. We do have a lot of variations going on there,
Yeah.
and it'd be wise to pay attention.
Yeah, what I've read is that at the moment they have identified between how many? I can't remember if it's, I know I think that they think that we go through 20,000 to 40,000 emotional states per day. And I don't know how many thousands of potential existing emotions there are.
Yes, and you could move to different cultures, and you could
Yes.
argue probably effectively that certain ones take the foreground in that culture versus another one. And I mean, I'm someone who, as you might guess from the experience of living in Italy and studying at Oxford, I've lived overseas, I've traveled vastly overseas, I've used facial coding in either in market research or as a tourist in probably about 80 countries. And so, yes, there is a wealth of things going on, but then you have to understand you're in a business context and the meeting only goes for an hour. And if I try to take them through 2,000 permutations, we're not going to get anywhere. So I can't leave it super simple and I cannot make it utterly complex and be effective. I
Right.
have to fall somewhere in between those two extremes.
Yeah, that's why I noticed when I created the ethical persuader and the impact system is that you have to convert all that science into something that people can use, in fact, and every day,
Yes.
and so that they don't become a neuroscientist just to get more from other people.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons I can break through is I'm trying to get them to a truth. It's an emotional truth, but I'm trying to get them to a truth because the one thing that I think they can all understand, even if they can't get to 2,000 permutations or 20,000 emotions in their day, they can understand that they get lied to because the people who report to them in the office lie to them, their bosses lie to them. That is part of the human predicament, is that there's a lot of duplicity that is going on. And what I'm trying to tell them is I'm trying to get a gut level read, but I take it through the face. And that's the underlying realities. You got to make the connection. You've got to establish your authenticity.
Right.
So if nothing else, I can always go back to saying trust is the emotion of business. Guess what? The opposite of trust is contempt. which means I don't trust you. I don't respect you. I find you beneath me. It is utterly destructive to marriages. It is not good to the brand customer relationship. Therefore, pay attention when contempt comes up. So if nothing else, I will say, ooh, here's where you're creating contempt. Here's where you're creating happiness. Here's where you're creating surprise, because surprise is an emotion, at least from facial expression perspective, means your eyes go wide. You're taking in more information. You're noticing the world around you. You're getting beyond the tiny little orb atop your shoulders, because we're all terribly egocentric. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, I will go to a few of those really basic emotions and maybe put the fear of the Lord in them. They don't pay attention. They may be out of a job someday because they're not going to get sales lift. And so, yeah, you play the game as you can to try to break through, because I care about what I do, and I don't want to simply, you know, talk to the airwaves. When I was an academic, I remember one point I thought I'd given a great lecture, and a student of mine put his hand over his head and, you know, gave me the signal that it had all been over his head and I'd lost him utterly. And that's not a good feeling.
So as you're talking about the face, I guess you are also a fan of Ekman's work.
Yes. Now, the funny thing is, you know, I actually took Ekman's system and made a change to it before he did, because the way he had originally devised it was that it was really hard to get to the quote-unquote full expression of the emotion. He had what I call chromosome chains, which means that you have three or four or five different facial actions, facial expression, muscle movements that together constituted showing that emotion. Well, I'm sorry, but in business, responding to commercial is not the same as the birth of your first child.
Right.
You are not going to have that full extensive range of feelings. You're going to have little shards, and you have to put together the pottery piece from the shards. So I just went back to the fundamentals of his system and said, this expression gives me this emotion, or maybe it gives me these two or these three or these four emotions. And
okay.
I've just got to work from those building blocks. So I think Paul did great work. And he did actually imitate me, because I think once he started trying to apply it outside of individual psychology, he came to realize that he's going to have to be more flexible than his original system was. And so ultimately, he imitated what I had done. So I respect Paul. I think he has made some changes to the system most recently that seem to me
okay.
trying to stretch it beyond what it can do. Because I think his first version was better. I mentioned I'm a literature guy. There's something called The Prelude by Wordsworth, a famous poem of his. Every literary scholar in the world agrees the first version was great. And when he went back 20 years later and rewrote it, he turned it into a piece of garbage. I'm not saying Paul turned it into a piece of garbage, but I like the first version better.
Okay. Amazing. Thanks. So, what would be some insights, some deep thoughts that you want to share with the audience?
Well, I think I've said an awful lot of them already, but I think I'll go back and hone in on a couple. The most important thing, I think, is to be on emotion. That on message just doesn't get you anywhere. And to your point, it's subtle as to where you're going to try to go to be on emotion. But I want to bring this down to ground level for listeners. So I want to give you an example. I'm thinking about a food commercial. I won't mention the client, but they're showing the family gathered around. It's the hearty meal. Everybody's happy. Commercial's doing quite well, even though it's kind of pretty much playing the happiness together kind of card. And then for some strange reason, the ad agency goes to a visual of a lone person on a beach, like you're out of season. And it created this sense of loneliness. Well, you've been playing the happiness card for 24 seconds. You're about to go into the branded clothes, and you throw people a curve. And everyone goes, huh? And they never recover. And the end of the commercial dies.
Okay.
So that's one. Let me go to a second example. It's a beer commercial. Now, we all know that Taking in alcohol is a lot of fun. We also know that taking in a lot of alcohol can ultimately be very detrimental to your health and maybe even your ability to be alive tomorrow if you get in the car and you drive someplace.
Right.
So what do? They create a commercial where they show a extreme skateboarder who is taking his life in his hands, and they show that in juxtaposition to their beer commercial. Well, ultimately, fear is a motivator, but only if you resolve the fear.
Right.
You put us back into a safe place. They kept showing the extreme skateboarder over and over. And ultimately, what fear can do is it can freeze you. And if you freeze, if you go into paralysis mode, I'm not motivated to move forward to embrace your product. So that's a terrible problem. Or I'll
Definitely.
give you one. I'll give you just one more. So it's a commercial. This is a visual medium. So you have a commercial where you have two Caucasian women who are in a kitchen where all the appliances are white. They're supposedly in heaven, and so they've dressed the women in white. The product is off-white, and they are mixing it in a bowl where the only visual on screen is a little small dab of blue, which is the color of the spatula. So you have white on white on white on off-white with a little touch of blue. And for about 10 seconds, which is one third of your commercial, everybody leaves the room because there's no visual contrast. There is nothing to respond to.
Okay.
And so,
Or you want to buy the spatula?
yeah, so yes, do I want to buy the spatula? Exactly. That's wonderful. Thank you. So these are the practicalities because I can imagine some listeners go, well, this is all great. We've got billions of emotions happening inside of us, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm clueless and I'm trying to bring it down to practicalities, ways you save your commercial from yourself and make it actually sing for people. Because the bottom line is you do have to engage, you do have to connect, and then you do have to try to get it to emotional literacy so you can recognize what's working, not working, and why. And so it comes in lots of permutations, but that is the endless task that I have given myself in trying to help my clients.
Nice, very nice. So where can our auditors find you? You have a website, you have books. Where can they
Oh
connect with you?
yeah, I'm crazy, so I've written 10 books over time.
Only 10.
So you can certainly find those on Amazon under Dan Hill. But yeah, the website, of course, is the company's name, Sensory Logic, as in your five senses, because that's really how the brain works. We're sensory emotive creatures, and that's the title I chose. I wanted to go to emotional logic, but I realized I'd probably be bankrupt because when I started in 1998, emotions weren't on most people's radar screen, and trying to put that in front of male executives was going to be a big stretch. It was a lot easier to go to, yeah, we have five senses. Let's start there.
Excellent, excellent. So, Dan, thanks so much. It was an honor to have you on the podcast and to listen to you sharing all this. Any last words you want to
I love your smile. I love your
share?
sense of humor. I love
Thanks.
your warmth. You were a wonderful host. So it was so much fun talking to you. That's what I really want to share.
Thank you. Then I leave it on that. So, guys, talk to you soon. Bye bye.